This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, friends. It's your boy, Michael Cruz Kane, and I'm back again with another episode of A Good Cry, this time with the lovely Jason Ritter. Jason first came into my consciousness as Kevin on Joan of Arcadia, shout out to Joan, and then really like hammered himself into my memory forever on the TV show Parenthood as Mark, where he is incredible along with everybody else. If you haven't seen Parenthood, I highly recommend you watch it. It's one of those shows that has my favorite mix, which is a little bit of humor, a little bit of, oh my gosh, there's so much faith and potential in humanity, and then a lot of, hang on, I think I'm crying so much that I might have to go to the hospital. He's been in Drunk History if you're a comedy fan. He was on Girls. He was in A Million Little Things. He's a great actor, and what I learned in this episode is that he's also a great dude. We talked a lot about his dad, John Ritter, who, this is not overstating it, is a comedy legend and who died when Jason was 23. So we talk about what it was like to lose his dad that young. We talk about the weird shit that people said to him around that time. We talk about how he thinks of his dad as he's parenting now. And we talk about a quote that I haven't been able to shake since we recorded this episode. And I'm going to get it wrong, but this is the gist of it. There is no more painful state than remembering the future, particularly one that you can never have. I know if you're listening to this, that is something that you can relate to. He says it much better than I do, so I'm just going to get out of the way and let Jason talk some more. This is A Good Cry with Jason Ritter. Jason, thanks for joining me. To get our podcast started, the question we ask off the top is, how would you describe your relationship to grief?
Oh, boy. Well, I think that, you know, it's something that I'm used to a certain degree, as much as you can get used to it. You know, no one wants to be friends with grief. It's sort of thrust upon you. So I have an interesting relationship with grief, as I think everybody does. I've never met any person who's had the same journey through grief that I have or that each other has. It's such a unique thing, which is why it's interesting. I think anytime I've talked to anybody about grief, it's interesting to hear, you know, we've all had this same monster to slay. How have you been handling it? Well, not well, a little bit of both, you know, but it's always helpful because every once in a while, you know, in these conversations about it, you can find something that goes, oh, that actually might work with my version of grief. I might be able to utilize that tool.
When you talk about that, is that something you're like seeking out? Like, are you like or is this like you're just in the world operating and you happen to find something? You're like, oh, that actually resonates with me when I think about loss or whatever.
I guess it's more like that. You know, at the time where my grief was the strongest and, you know, most powerful version of itself, I was actively seeking it out because it was hard to see or feel anything else. You know, it's a very overwhelming emotion at first. And then it's interesting because it's weird. It stays the same size. It doesn't shrink as a monster, but you get more used to it. You're like, oh yeah, there he is. He's in the corner. Hey, right. I'm not as scared. I can still go to work, but yeah. Oh, you're here today? All right.
Right. There's a massive beast behind me that might make me cry later, just so you know. Yeah. I know he's here.
Exactly. Exactly. I can see him revving up, getting excited. But yeah, so, you know, I think I actively seek it out less. But then, you know, like when I heard about your podcast, I was like, oh, great. An opportunity. We can, you know, who knows? With this may be completely useless to to any of us, or it could help us or someone listening. And I think that's the beautiful thing about it. And the beautiful thing about your podcast is just like,
well, thank
there's
you.
So much to explore, and it's helpful even to hear someone with a wildly different experience of it facing.
I hope so. I hope that that's true, or I am wasting so many people's time.
Exactly.
So you talked about what the time when your grief was the strongest. I'm assuming that that's when your dad died in 2003.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that's the strongest. I mean, there, I had been around death before that, but that was certainly the strongest and the closest, you know, family member. And yeah, and that was like the grief. I think the grief that I experienced when I was a teenager, a friend of mine lost her life in an accident, and it was shocking and awful. But I don't think I even had the capacity to understand the depth of it. In fact, I feel like I was able to sort of more understand my feelings about that when I was 23 and my dad passed. But yeah, that is for sure. That's the big one.
Yeah, I think like I empathize with that. I had known people who had died when I was a teenager, but weirdly, I always was like, am I not as sad as I'm supposed to be about this? Like, for whatever reason, even if I knew them, it didn't reach to like the center of me, like when my son died. I mean, obviously it makes sense that one would be more powerful than the other.
Right.
But
of course.
It, like, death sort of meant nothing to me. It felt like somebody else's, it's like on a channel that I'm not watching.
Yeah. I mean, I think I had a lot of anger about it and a lot of, I certainly was, I felt sad, but it didn't. Yeah, I maybe there's something about being a teenager where you're sort of roll with punches more or something. I don't know. I mean, but the gut punch, that was in 2003 for sure.
And can you talk a little bit about like how you found out?
Yeah, it was it was just a regular day, and I'd seen him earlier that week, and everything seemed, you know, normal. And then I was seeing an old friend from high school who I hadn't seen in years. And, you know, we were sort of acquaintances. We weren't like really close friends. It was like, oh, yeah, we went to the same school. Yeah, let's get a dinner. We'll chat about what's been going on. And my phone was buzzing in my pocket, but I didn't want to be rude because also it was like, again, it wasn't someone that I was so close to. I could just go, hey, excuse me, hold on. I'm just still trying to. And then I got all these missed calls from my stepmom, and I called her back. She said, your dad's in the hospital. He had a heart attack, but, you know, we caught it pretty quick. And so my mom and I hooked up and drove straight to the hospital. And I remember kind of having a feeling of, I was scared, but I also was sort of looking forward to this new sort of future where we had had a scare and we could all sort of acknowledge how close we are at all times to this scary thing. And we could, you know, we could all get closer and, you know, I started thinking about all the things that I wanted to do now that this scary thing had happened, but it sounded like he was going to be okay.
You were like operating under the assumption that he was going to be fine. Like, now we've had this big scare, this is really going to teach us a lesson about life and we'll act differently going forward.
Exactly. He walked into the hospital across the street because he was feeling weird. They said he's having a heart attack, but you know, we got it. And then it turned out to be not a heart attack. It turned out to be an aortic dissection, and everything that you do for a heart attack is not what you're supposed to do for, you know, a tear in the aorta. But the point of me saying that I was creating this new thing is I was already building up this new future in my head of the things I wanted to say, the things I wanted to, you know, the way I wanted our relationship to be. And I was almost grateful for this sort of wake-up call or something like that. And then at a certain point, they came in and, you know, they said they stopped working on him, which was such a strange, I mean, there's no easy way to say it, but essentially they had been fighting a losing battle for quite a while at that point, and eventually just called it, I guess. And yeah, and that was the beginning of it. I went home, you know, my mom and I called my brother and sister who were both away in college, and we had a whole thing where we like made sure that someone was waiting. Like we called other people that were around them first to make sure someone was waiting for them.
That's really thoughtful.
Yeah, that was all my mom's plan, and we got plane tickets, and basically we were like, after we had this horrible call, it was like, so-and-so's outside. They're going to take you to the airport. You're coming home. And they were able to meet together at an airport and then fly into Los Angeles together. And then I still remember picking them up from the airport and their little, you know, my mom and I had been sort of on our own little trip about it, but seeing their faces, you know, they had started to see also like the news was starting to say, you know, it had gotten to that point. So they saw like on an airport TV, you know, sort of made it feel more real for them in that moment. And then, yeah. And then we all embarked on this journey together.
And your siblings were still in college. You're the oldest.
I'm the oldest. My two older siblings were in college. My brother had just gotten dropped off a couple weeks before. My sister was starting her junior year. And my youngest sibling turned 5 that day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So like, as an oldest child myself, I'm like using stereotypes here, but I imagine that there is like a leadership. Do you feel a sense of responsibility as the oldest child and the oldest son, particularly in that time, to like fulfill a role that maybe yourself, I'm sure everybody feels responsibilities that are different.
Of course.
If there's anything specific.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, also as a child of divorce, I was the man of the house,
right.
You know, like to a certain extent. And, yeah, I definitely felt like that thing of, well, here, I gotta figure out how to lead us out of these woods. And just feeling completely ill-equipped to help at all. I mean, that's the strange thing is you're looking for help. No one can really help you. I mean, even the people who had gone through things like this were like, I actually know that there's nothing that I can say, you know, like
the best thing I can tell you is this is going to be horrendous for a while.
Yeah. And, you know, if you need anything, but I know you won't, you know, it's interesting because all of a sudden out of the woodwork come all of the little grief warriors who have been on their own journey. And it's sort of like a moment of like, welcome brother. It's tough. You know, we gotta still go on our own thing. But, that turns out to be the biggest, weapon you have is the kind of the community of people who have experienced things like it or not.
And
like
it is like that, like secret army of warriors is really, that makes a lot of sense to me, that feeling. Cause like you said, so many people have an issue that is, you know, in some way, but not always resembles yours and mine.
Oh yeah.
But they're never talking about it. So once this horrible thing happens, you know, your friend that, you know, your friend from work or whatever, you're the makeup artist on set is like, hey, I saw what happened. I just want to, and you've met that person 1,000 times.
Oh, yeah.
And never knew that her dad also died or whatever.
Oh, that was exactly my experience. I was working on a show. And when I went back to work, people that I had been working with for a couple months were like, my dad died. You know, it was like a secret club. It's like the Illuminati or something. Like, I'm part of it. I'm also part of it. And, you know, and, you know, no one wants to be a member of that club. But yeah, there is like, there's a certain badge of honor.
And well, it's also like a thing where if someone's not in the club, as you put it, it's like kind of hard to talk to them about the club. Cause they like, even the loveliest, most thoughtful, best listeners, it's like, I can tell you about this club all day and night. You will not understand the club until you're in the club.
100%. And a very close friend of mine, when he was 6, and I was 6 too, his mother passed away. And I had spent my whole life talking to him, trying to help reach that. And I never quite, yeah, exactly what you said. You just cannot quite understand it. As well-intentioned as I was, I think the problem is one of the things that is a natural thing that we all do is to say, oh, you know what I imagine would help me if I was in your position is this. And it's so unique to everybody that there's no way you can happen to land on the complicated journey of grief.
Incredibly lucky.
Yeah, exactly. I think it would be really helpful if you just like cried for 2 months straight, but then so without that piece of knowledge, it's really difficult for people who don't have that piece to help. I mean, it's hard for people who do have that understanding to help as well. It's just it's a tough, awkward, painful thing. And, you know, things that you imagine would feel nice to you sometimes feel the opposite to someone who's going through it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I also think maybe there are some people, there are probably a lot of people listening to this podcast who are listening to it because someone they love is grieving and they don't know how to, you know, they're trying to learn themselves and listen and figure out how they can help in whatever ways.
Yeah, that's a great point. Are there things that people did for you, even if they weren't like the exact right thing, that you remember from that time being like, I liked it when someone did this?
Yes, absolutely. There was a guy who told me that when his mom passed away, he was meeting a lot of people who wanted to grieve her on him, like with him, you know, and would like come up to him regardless of how he was feeling in any particular moment and just start weeping and kind of, they were looking for a sort of like a commiseration of like, oh, we're both feeling this. And, you know, I remember him saying like, oh yeah, can I get you a glass of water or anything? Like, this is his mom who passed away. But yet he feels like I have to take care of you in this moment because just by seeing me, you are triggered into having this emotional reaction.
Yes.
And now all of a sudden you want to go there with me. And I'm not in a position to do that right now. So that was helpful just in terms of feeling that every feeling you're feeling at any given time is natural and is okay. He obviously was devastated by his mom's passing, and the fact that he couldn't cry with every single person who wanted to cry with him was not a sign that he was dead inside or, you know, or a sociopath or anything. And that's continued to be really helpful, especially because.
And there must've been a lot of people who felt that way about you because your dad is such like a public beloved figure. You know, it's not like the pediatrician down the street died. It's like America's favorite man.
Right. So there have been a lot of times where I've had very firm handshakes and teary eyes and like an intense moment where someone wants to, or I've had the opposite where, you know, actually when I was first dating my current wife, there was a moment where we were at a bar and we were talking and this woman turned around to me and was like, I just wanted to say, like, I loved your dad so much. And I was like, so sad when he died and blah, blah, blah. And then she just went RIP and put her hand on her heart and then turned back around. And I didn't have a chance to say anything. And it was awkward because I was right in front of Melanie. And so just to her back, I just quietly under my breath so she couldn't hear me, I went, well, thank you so much for bringing it up. You know, a lot of my closest friends are afraid to bring up such a tender subject with me, but I'm glad you did. You know, just had like a long conversation. This was so weird to say RIP. And it also actually reminded me of a story that my dad told me when his dad passed away, where this guy, this sort of like smooth talking, cool guy who was in college with him, went up to him, hey man, I heard about your dad. Condoles. And he's like, oh, condoles?
Condoles.
Yeah. Don't have time to say the whole word.
Saving a little money.
Yeah. we got places to be, but I wanted you to know that I send my condoles to your whole family. So that was a running joke in our household for quite a while. Is, hey, condoles.
Condoles.
Yeah, it was like before totes, you know, before a lot of the abbreves.
Yeah, that guy's a pioneer.
He was a pioneer, and especially on such an intense word. He's a brave a brave man.
He's really pushing the envelope to go abbreviation on condolences. I mean, that guy's avant-garde.
I know, seriously. So I've had a lot of, some condoles, moments and, but yeah, it's been, yeah, I mean, and I understand, I never want to take away someone's moment if they want to share how much he meant to them. And, you know, it's meaningful to me. I love hearing those stories. It's just when I feel like they're expecting me to be anywhere specifically emotionally. And there's a part of me that's like, if you saying this to me in this moment were to make me burst into tears, which there's a small but chance that you could just catch me at the right moment, would you then sit down with me and talk to me, or would it get awkward?
Right, is that
you?
What is you
this,
want?
Yeah. Is this only a one-way emotional street, or could I rely on you in this moment as well? And, you know, I never really feel like he's a stranger, but I always sort of, I wonder about that. Like,
yeah, that feeling you talk about of like your friend saying to you that you often have to spend time consoling, giving your condoles to
yeah,
the people who ostensibly should be consoling you.
Right.
It's very relatable and very common. And I don't, you know, like you said, I don't hold that against anybody.
No,
like,
absolutely.
You know, the thing that this happened to me, you can't, I mean, you can imagine it on paper, but you can't imagine the feelings of it. And trying to imagine it is absolutely obliterating you. And I get that. It's yeah. It's obliterating.
Yeah. It's obliterating is a good word. You get used to that feeling after a while.
Can you talk a little bit about, you know, it's been almost 20 years since your dad passed.
So crazy.
How has like the way that you think about his death and, you know, the grief that the intensity of the grief that you felt then, how have those things changed in, you know, almost two decades?
So when I first was grieving, I was looking for anything and everything to help. I was making stuff up. I was looking at things, I was reading things. I was just trying to figure it all out. And now, so one of the things that really helped me early on, well, the first thing that I just was grasping at straws, I was like, I don't even know what I'm doing. I don't even know how to do this. There was just this part of me that believed that no one had ever said this to me, or this is not part of my belief system, but I just believed, I just felt like I knew for some reason that after my dad passed, that someone had handed him a paintbrush and he was able to do some of these sunsets that I was seeing. Cause I was seeing like incredible sunset after incredible sunset. And it was these moments of beauty. And I guess there was just something comforting of like, this is a gift from him somehow. He wasn't like a painter. He wasn't a good painter. Like, I'm not like, oh, I recognize this. I just was like, maybe this is, maybe that's what he's doing. But then the thing that...
And when you say, sorry, I'm interrupting you for one second, but when you say like it wasn't part of your belief system, do you mean that, because I felt like sort of like before my son died, when people would talk about shit like that, I'd be like, okay, that sounds legitimately insane.
Yeah.
And now that it's happened and talking with more people who've suffered loss or grief of whatever kind, they're like the possibilities of those things crack open for a lot of people in a way that they wouldn't have.
100%. Yeah, that exactly. I mean, I definitely have my beliefs about the world and the afterlife and all sorts of things like that. But this is just your brain being rocked and like, and the trauma response of like grabbing onto whatever is there and whatever is comforting. And in those moments, I think almost whatever is comforting, whatever you're having to do to get through those periods, whatever mental, emotional gymnastics are helping in some way, I say, as long as it's not, you know, hurting anybody else, that's why I say almost any, like, it really helped me to murder other people.
Yeah, robbing these banks is really helping me get through.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I found myself doing that a lot. And you just, you know, you're constantly looking for things in television shows or in books or whatever that you're looking for any little thing that you know, it's like you're trying to open a coconut. You're like, this is impossible. I'm smashing it. I'm dropping it from places. And like, you're hoping for someone to go, oh, you know, hit it right here. Or like hit a nail in there and then you can crack it open easier. You're just looking for any new thing because smashing it and, you know, doing all these things is not necessarily helping. You get the coconut milk of your healing. See, that's the, so I remember there was this one thing that I heard where it was this Kierkegaard quote, I guess, where it was the most painful state of being is remembering your future, remembering the future, particularly one you can never have. And I heard that and I recognized that immediately as the main thing that I was doing in that period of time, which is that future that I had constructed on the way to the hospital, or even before that, the future that I had of, you know, him seeing me be a dad myself, or all of these things in the future that I was going, oh, wait, I don't get to do this. 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 And I was remembering this future that I was never going to be able to have. And hearing it sort of put like that helped me recognize, oh, that is, and I, you know, I'm obviously, I still do that to some degree, but I was doing that almost obsessively. And it helped me to kind of think of it as opposed to like a book where the final, however many chapters had been ripped out. And I was like, oh, well, I was liking this book, that, that maybe those chapters were ripped out, but that I can't find them anywhere. You know, like, this is the story that I have. And can I find beauty in these pages that I have gotten to read and that I feel lucky to have read? Because these chapters could have been ripped out too, for, you know, for all I know.
Yeah, and it's a fucking great book.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But yeah, I mean, that, you know, that's something in at 23, losing something that was something that I could do in a way that my five-year-old brother couldn't do. You know, right. Like everybody, even in the same tragedy, has their own journey through it, which is why it's hard to help.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
A question that I ask specifically of people who are, well, of everybody, but people who are involved, like your dad was a comedian. He must have had like tons of very funny friends, and you're obviously a very funny person. Were there times after he died, or even like, I feel like the funerals often have times like this, where there are things that happened that made you laugh, that like weirdly brought you joy, even in like the most horrible times?
Oh, yeah. I mean, strangely, and this is actually also true of when my friend Holly Bendick passed away in 94, 95. The hardest I've ever laughed in my entire life, strangely. Like I think it's because there's so much emotion. And it's like, as soon as there's something a little bit funny, it's like this pressure valve just opens up and you're still like on the verge of tears. But it's hard to even remember. I'm trying to remember. I know that my brother and my sister recently reminded me of something that I said in that awful, awful period of time that like kind of broke open that first laugh. And I don't even remember. I the first laugh in an exceedingly silent world. You know, my dad was such a force of nature. And when someone who has that much energy and that much presence is gone, it's like, wait, it's like in Psycho when you know, the lead that you've been following is killed. You're like, wait, who? Now I have to, now I'm following these guys?
Like, who else is in this movie?
The bad guy? Wait, what's the, yeah, it's bizarre. You're like, wait, it's a, we're, now we're all these side characters who are having to create this, these, this new reality. But yeah, I wish I could remember what it was that, that cracked it open, but it's just, I think there's something so absurd and hard to grasp about the finality and the, just the no going backness of losing someone, that everything takes on a, an absurd quality to a degree. I mean, I remember a couple, maybe like a week after my dad passed, I was at my stepmom's house and a little mole had crawled up like onto the cement and was like kind of confused. And it was so bizarre and strange. I've never seen a mole in my life before or after, but it was so clearly out of its element. It was just like, is there ground anywhere near? I gotta get back in. And we were all just sort of laughing at the strangeness and the absurdity. And also that felt like some kind of, you know, thing to
it
hold
does
on
feel
to.
Like the absurdity of everything you do all the time, I feel like is heightened, especially by like a sudden death.
Yeah.
That like when you return to the world that you're like, so people just like go to McDonald's, like people just do that. That's a regular thing that we just keep doing it and it's fine.
That,
or whatever. Every part of your daily routine, you look at it and you're like, why is this part of what we do?
That is this, that's such a strange part of it. And that's one of the universal things that I think I've talked to, like anyone who's gone through it, is there's the moment of when it happens and the funeral and the friends. And then like the moment where everything goes back to normal for everybody, except for you, is so bizarre. You're like, oh yeah, people just going, getting their coffee, people going to, eventually I'll be one of those people, I guess. But
yeah,
there's a sort of like, how can you, at least for me, there was almost like a strange disgust with humanity. I was like, none of this means anything. What are you all doing?
That's very natural though.
Yeah.
It's hard to not feel that way.
Yeah. Just happy. Just like totally happy. No, no world rocking. You know, but then how many times have we been the person in the Starbucks getting a coffee right in front of, you know, someone who else?
A lot of the time, 100% of the time.
Yeah, I'm exactly, that person. Exactly.
Yeah. I would like to say that like my acquaintance with loss has made me a better person, but it absolutely, I know that it has not. I know that like, I'm still a dirtbag who like gets mad when people beep their cars behind me.
Right. Exactly. I know you don't immediately become like a Zen master of
right. Like I know about one more together, thing that I didn't know about.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Do you feel like you have learned from grief? Like, do you feel like your dad's death and the way you or other people responded to it changed you?
I definitely feel changed. And God, it's hard to say. I mean, I know that I've learned something. And and you definitely start thinking about your own mortality more. This may just be specific to people with, you know, maybe in a similar scenario, but because at the end of the day, if my dad had known that this genetic thing that, you know, that we think that his dad passed of, his brother survived because we knew about it from my dad. This
oh, wow. So his brother had the same thing happen.
A couple years later, his brother got scanned, as we all do in my family now, and his aorta had started to balloon. So they went in and they like, you know, created a little mesh around it and saved his life.
I didn't realize it was genetic.
It can be. So, you know, I've met a lot of people who, you know, we're catching up with the science and all that stuff. So sure. I've met a lot of people who have found out that it's genetic, who before they knew that it was genetic, had a similar thing to my family, which is this sort of legend of all of the men on my dad's side of his family dying young from their first and last heart attack. And now we think, oh, it's because it was never a heart attack. It was this thing. So we're working with this, my stepmom has this John Ritter Foundation of Aortic Health. And one of the things that they do is they work with this doctor named Diana Milowitz, who is trying to figure out all of the different genes that can create this weakening of the aortic wall, which is amazing. And she's found a whole bunch of genes. My family's specific gene hasn't been found yet, but she's still, she's just looking, and it's a lot of it is like taking as much information from as large of a group as possible and seeing, where the similarities are. And, but anyway, one thing I have learned a lot is about aortas, but the other thing that I was gonna say is, had my dad known this, he may have been able to combat it. And I just know that, he would have done anything to stay here for longer. And I think up until that point, I had a sort of a fatalistic view on death. I sort of was like, well, when it's your time, or something like that. And now I don't feel like that. And especially now that I have a daughter, I'm like, how can I live as long as I possibly can? What can I, there's a period of time where I was like, if it happens, it happens, and that's it. And now I really just, there's something about that you can, sometimes it's completely unavoidable. But with my specific case, I feel like at least I can avoid that way of going, as I have the knowledge about it.
How old is your daughter?
She's three and a half.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Three and a half. Okay. My son is 12 and my daughter is 9. Three and a half is...
Oh, wow.
Three and a half is busy, right? Like, that's like all the words are happening.
Oh, yeah. All the words.
You talked about your dad not being there to see you become a dad. Are you channeling your dad when you're raising your daughter at all?
Yeah, there's a lot of his, he was such a great dad. And there are lots of his little tricks that I'm stealing. The most interesting thing is I had this moment where my daughter was sort of understanding about grandparents and, my wife's parents. And we started talking about my dad, and I said, oh, your granddad would have loved you so much. And I had this blast of my dad constantly saying that to us growing up, because his dad had died before I was born. So, and he would say that, and I would go, yeah, that's too bad. I didn't quite understand the pain of that until saying it to my daughter and going, oh, I wish you guys could meet, for him, for you. And it was just so fascinating to feel like I was on the other end of that conversation with a whole new set of understanding about what that meant. And I felt like I had an insight to, I also knew that my dad's dad died when he was in his 20s, and I didn't fully understand that until my dad died in my 20s. There's just this sort of, I felt like I knew him, I knew a piece of him better,
sure,
afterwards.
That's beautiful. I mean, yeah, that's that same thing of like, you could never have understood.
No, right, matter, exactly.
Like, in spite of him trying in a loving way to make you understand something, there was no way.
Of course. And he showed me some of, my granddad's movies, and I heard his voice, I heard his songs and recordings and things like that, and I got a sense of him. And I'm doing the same thing for my daughter. I'm like, oh. But it's just like, there's this strange feeling of being a bridge between these two lives that didn't connect. And you're like, oh, I wish I could just tie this end to this end for one second. But, you do what you can.
Yeah. You talked about your dad painting the sunset for you. Do you think of your dad as being someplace now?
This is the thing that I've sort of grappled with the most, I think, because first of all, when I have had dreams about him, which I haven't had in a long time, but I love them. They're great. They're very painful, but they feel real to me. They feel like a little visit. And I don't know if he's out there. I mean, I think it would be so awesome to be able to float around and, somehow watch your family. I mean, that is like, when I think of the afterlife, I think of just all of the things that made you human, all of your bad qualities, your selfishness, all of the jealousy, all of the things that are not sort of love, or the things that twist us and make us things, that are all taken away when you pass, and you're just able to see exactly objectively how you affected the world and the people around you. And that's either your heaven or your hell, and probably somewhere in between. You just see like, wow, this is how I made all these people happy. I made this person really sad. I really hurt this person, or I just was a nightmare all the way through, or whatever it is.
Everyone hates me.
Wow, I really did a bad job. This feels not good to spend eternity. But I think the more than that, I feel like people download little pieces of themselves into your heart and brain, and that is like where I feel him. I don't ever feel him like standing in a room or something like that, but I do feel him in my heart. I feel him. I feel like I can even sort of conjure up a conversation with him, and it feels like, it doesn't feel like AI or something where like I fed them a bunch of things and it's like, oh yes, here's all the jokes. I feel like I knew him and the, as much as you can ever know someone. And I feel like maybe that's where that's where they go. I mean, who knows, but
sure.
But I do know that Keanu Reeves said, someone, I think he's on a talk show, and someone said like, you know, what happens when we die? Have you seen this clip?
I have. Yeah.
Yeah.
We ask everyone to end the show with their favorite Keanu Reeves quote.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. I know that those who love us will miss us.
That's great.
Yeah.
It's like, it's very profound and true. Like, it's one of those things that like in its simplicity is like, oh, right.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that the missing of these people that we would rather not be missing if we had the choice, that's the love, and that's what sort of keeps them alive and in our memories and in our minds. And you know, again, like that's just what it's sort of been like for me. I know it's different for everybody. I mean, I know that my dad actually had a moment where he saw his grandfather at the foot of his bed shortly after his passing, you know, telling him like, you gotta look out for your mom and your brother. And no matter how many people were like, well, maybe it was a dream, or maybe, you know, he was like, that was him. He just knew. And again, who knows if it was actually outside or his brain created that and whatever it was, but it was real to him in a.
Yeah. Functionally, those things are the same.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You talked about that Keanu Reeves quote made me think of something you said earlier, which was that you were like very fatalistic about dying before, but now that you have a daughter, that you're like, well, I'm going to actually try and live forever now if I can.
Yeah, exactly.
And I feel, I really do empathize with that of like, you know, if the plane's going through turbulence when I'm on the plane, I'm like, well, this is it. We're all going to die.
Right.
And I'm just like at peace with it. Truly, I like close my eyes and go to sleep. And I'm like, come and get me.
Yeah.
But now that I have kids, I really do like, I do think like, oh, if I died, like my kids, my wife, I love my wife very much. I know she loves me, but she would be fine.
Right.
If I died, my kids would be, it would fuck them up so bad.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe I'm overestimating myself, but no. I do think they need me.
Yes.
So
yes, they do.
My point of view has changed on that now that I have kids. And I mean, yeah, this having your father come from a string of fathers who have died young, I would imagine only reinforces that feeling.
Oh yeah, for sure. I'm like, I want to be, you know, I want all of my siblings to be, you know, I want this to be the generation of paternal grandfathers.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Great grandfathers.
Yeah, great grandfathers. Exactly. Why stop it at the regular ones?
Are there any times, Jason, now, all this time later, when you are overcome? Like, are there times when the memory of your dad or something else, like, will you'll need to take a time out to handle that emotionally?
Yeah. And I was actually shocked by it because I think I had so much time just doing my life and focusing on my family and work and, you know, everything else that I sort of was like, I guess I'm pretty much over it. And we were watching an episode of a reality show, and the guy's dad wasn't around. His dad had passed away, and I just felt weird afterwards. Like, I didn't immediately recognize what was going on. I just kind of felt like, oh, did I eat something weird? Or like, I just felt like kind of sick and dizzy and just weird. And the episode was over, and I finished up dinner and was like loading the dishwasher, and it just like hit me. And I haven't heard sounds like that come out of me for years. I mean, like, I'm an emotional person, and my tears will well up all the time. I'll have like a shaky voice sometimes if I'm talking about something, but this was like I couldn't even stand up. I was leaning over the dishwasher, just like sobbing is the only word for it. And I was shocked because I didn't realize, like, it wasn't that I had gotten stronger. Or I had like made the monster smaller. It was as big of a pain as it was right when it happened. And it's just, it was weird. It was like, oh, right. Like, you're just sort of changed by grief in a way where, you know, you can do all these things and you can refocus on other things, but it'll just find you sometimes and just be like, I'm still here. I've been doing pushups and, you know, like,
I'm actually very fit now.
Yeah. I was waiting for my moment, and, I knew when this episode came up. But yeah, it was, I was really shocked, and I felt like I continued my journey of learning about grief 18, 19 years after the original feeling. Just like, oh, yep, I still miss him just as much. I still wish he was here. I still wish that never happened. I still am imagining the future that I'll never have, you know, all that stuff.
Totally. I mean, that feeling, I don't know if this is a weird thing to say, but I feel it pretty deeply, which is that, like, when I felt grief originally, it was totally overwhelming 100% of the time. And now, years later, the moments where, like, I am overcome, I mean, obviously it's painful to feel, but there's also a part of me that's like, it's sort of like nice to have a moment where, like, okay, I know right now that I'm sad about this very specific thing.
Yes.
And I haven't been really sad about it for a minute. And it's weird. It's like, I don't know, it's almost like a pleasant memory that is also incredibly sad.
I completely agree. I mean, I think also the feeling of that overwhelming all 100% of the time was so crazy, and it was so impossible to imagine a world that looked anything close to normal at that point. And this was like, oh, wow, you're still here, but I know you now, and I know you're going to leave. And also, this has been inside me this whole time. Like, this pain is still there. And it, like you said, there was something sort of comforting about it. It's like, you know, yeah, you're familiar with it now. You're not like, oh my God, you know, I knew that after I finished and said to Melanie, like, oh, sorry about that. What was that all about? You know, she was obviously very supportive and everything, but I was just so shocked by it initially, but yeah, there was a familiarity to it, and there was a comfort to it, because it almost feels like a little homage to the original pain and the original person. Like, you are still missed. I was really surprised, because it had really been at least a decade or more that I had that intense of a cry about it.
Before I let you go, I just wanted to ask if there was anything on this subject that I didn't ask you about, but that you wanted to say.
I guess I would just say to anybody out there who's in the beginning stages of this journey or in the middle of it, I just would say listening to this podcast is a great step and listening to people talk about it is just a great step. And it's nice to have it in a podcast, as it's sort of safe. You don't have to necessarily share your thing. You can just listen. But that I think was the most helpful to me, is just hearing how other people put together this impossible puzzle, knowing that it may not relate to my little puzzle at all. But every once in a while, someone will say something and you'll go, yeah, actually, yeah, that is how I feel. And that feeling of community and feeling less alone in it, I think that's one of the main things, is you can feel so isolated and so alone, even though this is probably one of the oldest human emotions, animal emotions. You know, I mean, like, we're learning more and more about animals who, you know, experience grief too. It's just such a primal experience. And there's a lot of us out here who have faced it down and lived to tell the tale. And they will be one too one day for someone else.
Jason, thank you so much for doing this. This was Jason Ritter on A Good Cry. Thanks for listening. I hope it helps.
A Good Cry is brought to you by Radio Point and HeadGum, with executive producers Alex Bach, I'm talking Sabrina Fonfetter, and Daniel Powell. Of course, Richard Corson, and don't you forget Houston Snyder. It is also produced by V. Abigail Lowenthal and mixed and edited by the one and only Ian Sorrentino.